I'm Rick Hansen, and this is March 28th, right, 2012. And tonight I want to talk about and have some discussion about what in Buddhism is called rapture or bliss. Sounds pretty good, huh? And it is pretty good. And I want to put this particular mental factor or state of mind in context. And so the context that I've been working with, you may know from the last few weeks, is I'm talking through the seven factors of enlightenment or factors of awakening that the Buddha identified. And the framework here is the idea that what we experience moment to moment, as well as materiality, boom, 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 moment to moment, is an ongoing process. Some of those processes are slower than others, right? El Capitan is a pretty slow process. But there too, I actually had a rock climbing acquaintance who was aid climbing on El Capitan, which means he was putting things in the rock and then putting his weight on them. He climbed above a horizontal crack. He's probably 1,000 or 2,000 feet up, placed gear above the crack, and was standing in little stirrups that were clipped to the gear above the crack when he suddenly heard a loud noise, grinding, thrashing noise. And the sheet of rock he'd been standing upon and clipped to only 10 minutes before peeled away from the surface of El Capitan. It exfoliated, it's so called, much as skin exfoliates when we get a nice scrub. Anyway, this chunk of rock that was probably 100 feet long and maybe 50 to 100 feet deep and, you know, 6 inches or wide and 6 inches deep. Anyway, many, many tons peeled off, fell 1,000 or so feet to the valley floor. And he's clipped to little things, just looking down at this thing. So transience, right, impermanence takes many, many forms. And some of them, some of them are a little faster than others. So he recovered. He survived anyway. So things are continually changing, and they change due to causes, like exfoliation even in Yosemite National Park. And so the question is how to mobilize the causes of the things we want to have, and also how to put the brakes on and stop feeding and fueling the causes of things that are problematic. So in terms of this particular list, these are causes of awakening, and they are also causes of many more ordinary and everyday, wholesome, positive states of mind, and then the actions of thought, word, and deed that flow from these states of mind. So the seven enlightenment factors are mindfulness, investigation, energy, that was last week's, and then, or last time I talked on this, and then bliss or rapture, which leads to tranquility, which leads to deep concentration, non-ordinary states of awareness, which leads to equanimity. This is not necessarily a linear path, but there is a kind of flow to it. So I'm talking here about the factor that's called, translated generally as rapture or bliss, and in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, is known as piti. That's the word you may have heard before. And this particular topic is very relevant for deep meditative practice. And it starts getting connected with some of the more yogic or absorption or non-ordinary states of awareness that occur as people progress in practice and are seen as skillful means in practice as well. So for me at least, one of the neat things about this particular topic is it has a wow factor going on with it. So I want to talk about rapture or bliss, piti, in this light. So this factor of rapture or bliss, I would say, takes two kinds of forms. One kind of form is present often in formal meditative practice or other forms of intense absorption, like in yoga. Sometimes it comes in other sittings as well. And it's experienced as an acute rush of energy in the body, often has a pulsating quality, often feels like it's rising, often is very pleasurable, physically pleasurable as well. There's associated with it a kind of rapture or absorption in whatever one is aware of, like, whoa, wow, what beautiful breath, you know, or what an amazing orange. There's just a real involvement with it. It's quite a powerful experience. I've personally experienced it repeatedly. My observation about people is that there's a range of predilection to, I'll just call it bliss, because I think that's a good central word for it. Some people really are not very predisposed to this at all. So other people can kind of go into bliss just backing their car out of the garage, right? And then I'm kind of in the middle myself from personal experience. I'm sort of in the middle. So as I'll say more about later, if you have any difficulty getting into a bliss state, it just could be natural to your temperament. And the happy news is that you're not stymied in your progress toward awakening as a result. This is a particular awakening factor that people get interested in for obvious reasons, that can sometimes get attached to, and they can get frustrated around being unable to ignite. Because sometimes trying to ignite it is like getting a fire going with wet wood. It just won't ignite. Okay. So far now I'm describing what it is. That's the acute version. You know, whoosh, like that. The subtler version is a broader kind of feeling of, not so acute, it's more dispersed or pervading, of real enjoyment, real engagement, real sense of elevation even in mood, a kind of with an embodied quality to it. One is not getting manic, or in Jungian language, one is not getting inflated, but there is a pervading, somewhat atypical quality of delight. Delight would be another very good word. Passion, cooking, making love, playing with children. I think there's a lot of PT that happens playing with kids. One reason why I, as a longtime psychologist, I love getting down on the floor with these kids and doing all kinds of stuff with them. Because there's people laugh about that I get paid to laugh with children. But it's true. It's been wonderfully therapeutic for me, and hopefully for them too, about hanging out together in a state of delight, right? Being in nature sometimes, you know, this aspect of PT, if you will, can have a sort of quiescent quality, but it, like, oh my God, the waves, the ocean, the air, wow, you know, just wow. That's wow. Wow is another word that might be associated with this in more ordinary terms. Okay, so that's the territory here, defining terms here of PT, the awakening factor of rapture or bliss. Now, it's interesting that in Buddhism, this factor shows up a lot. Buddhism often is seen as a kind of grim religion or grim, you know, philosophy slash psychology, suffering, and more suffering, right? But it's really interesting how much the Buddha really did talk about positive emotion, gladdening the heart, the positive emotions of compassion and kindness, or taking joy in the welfare or good fortune of others. These are positive states. The awakening factors, as I've said, include bliss. The Buddha was someone who was perfectly prepared to engage the ascetic practices of his day to the point, literally, near death. The descriptions of his own state as he really progressed in the ascetic practices that are available in the Pali Canon are very striking. I mean, at one point, in one passage, he talks about starving himself to the point that, as he puts it, the bones stuck out of his body like the rafters of a house in which the roof has fallen down. I mean, literally his stomach, you know, you could see his backbone or touch his backbone through his stomach. He was so emaciated. So why would someone like that, who's perfectly prepared on a path of awakening to go all the way, why would he value so much these factors of intense pleasure, intensely pleasurable factors? Well, it's because they worked. You know, it's important, I think, to appreciate the degree to which the Buddha was a yogi. He was deeply trained in his tradition 2,500 years ago, in which people would really work with non-ordinary states of awareness. They would work with them, they would cultivate them, they would train in them, and they would marinate in them. It's interesting that there's a recurring passage in the Dharma about that one should be, with regard to rapture, or bliss, as I'm calling it, PT, as, to paraphrase, a bath man is with bath powder. I assume there were bath women as well, but that's the way it's said. As a bath person with bath powder, which is apparently dry, that one should need it, much as a bath person needs bath powder, needs it as in bread dough, with some liquid so that the liquid pervades the powder. Or much as someone, I think, in a more customary sense, creates bread dough with dry flour and then gets the eggs, the milk, whatever, in there and gets it all distributed. So too, we should distribute rapture and bliss throughout our entire body, which is not, which is advice, in a sense, from a teacher who says this is how to do it, to let the rapture pervade you, to really cultivate it, to intensify it even, as skillful means. Now, the key point, of course, since it's so pleasurable, is to stay out of the trap of getting attached to it, or, you know, fixed on having it, or caught up in not being able to get it. It's a means to an end. And another thing about this, as a means to an end, the Buddha is extremely matter-of-fact about it. If you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, just the description there, in right concentration, there are these four non-ordinary states called the jhanas. And in the description of the jhana is rapture, is piti, rapture, bliss, or certainly in the first two. By the third, rapture tends to fade away to be replaced by even more sublime and wonderful states of peacefulness and happiness and contentment. But it's very matter of fact, is the point. It's within reach. This is not seen as some esoteric state of mind that only the really cool people can access, but that actually it's a kind of intermediate practice to be able to get in touch with rapture or bliss or this quality of delight. So I have a question for you. This goes to a larger point here. What's the place in our own lives for that which is extraordinary? This is a fairly extraordinary state, right? It's not, we're not in Kansas anymore when we experience it. And it raises a real question, doesn't it? Like, what room is there in our lives for that which is magnificent? Or, to use a word, sacred. Sacred means set apart, because it's holy in some way. One can relate to the word sacred in a theistic frame, which is probably how a lot of us have heard it. If that frame troubles you at all, it's really fine to step out of that frame and still ask yourself, what is precious to me? What is worthy of cherishing? What do I want to create sanctuary for in my life? What is sacred to me? Including remarkable states of mind, whatever they might be. They might be deeply joyful, might be blessed, might be very bodily pleasurable. They might be subtle, like a remarkable quality of attunement with another person and mutuality of presence with each other. It might be heart-stopping gratitude. It might be a sense that certain things are so important that everything needs to stop to protect them. You know, this child is upset right now. Everything stops till we get this worked through somehow. What's sacred? So I want to pause here for a moment, just in quiet for about 20-ish seconds, and encourage a reflection here about where you're at with that which is sacred or that which is magnificent for you, in particularly states of mind or mental factors, you know, intentions, commitments. What commitments are sacred to you? You hold dear. You set them apart. You protect them because they're so precious to you. You know, if your house were burning, what are the things you would grab? So more intangibly, if your life is burning, and the Buddha used that language quite often, what is it that we want to protect? What do we want to save? I'll just be quiet for a little bit, and then we maybe could talk about it for a moment. It's a worthy reflection in general. As a detail in passing, I'll say from a retreat I did about a year and a half ago, led by Ajahn Suchito, an English man who is abbot of one of the two main Theravadan monasteries in England. Anyway, he talked about offering one's practice to the sacred, or offering one's day to that which, whatever it is for you, not the party line sacred, but what's sacred for you, offering to it, and how important that is. So that became meaningful to me, to reflect on offering my practice or offering my good intentions or just whatever the benefits are of my actions to that which is sacred. Okay. So any discussion or question or comment about making room in your mind and room in your life, room in your schedule for that which is magnificent or extraordinary or sacred? Is the idea clear? That's clear, right? The idea is clear, at least. Yeah. You might give an example of that which is perhaps sacred to you or not. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's not 100% clear to me what you mean in terms of do you mean like something you like to do? I'm not real clear on that.
Yeah, great. Thank you for that. So what I mean is, first, I'm struck, you know Thoreau's classic line, it's gendered, but we can update it. I'll update it. He says, most people lead lives of quiet desperation. I don't know about desperation, at least in a material sense, for many people these days, but I would call it the quiet blahs, the quiet beige. Not that there's anything wrong with beige, but it's like there's a kind of dulling that happens. You think about the delight. Look at young children, the delight there, the extraordinariness of what happens in their mind quite often. And then we kind of tend to settle. We tend to drift. We tend to get ground down. We get weary. You know, the grays come in, not just in the hair. The grays come in, you know. That's what I mean. So one, where is there an opening to or a preserving of or creating sanctuary for that which is not gray? And a holding out for that, not just for sitting on the beach for one day of one week of one's vacation per year, you know, but actually as a daily matter, where's the room for that which is elevated, remarkable, beautiful? So that's one. And then also more generally, what's sacred to you in whatever ways that word means something to you? Holy, or to be set aside, or to be really protected. A little thing I'll tell you, Tara Brach has this great phrase, the sacred pause. And one of the things that is sacred for me, in a sense, that I protect seriously, is when a demand comes at me, I protect my time to respond. Obviously, tiger jumps out of the bushes, I'm in an instant. But in general, just because they have an urgency doesn't impose an obligation upon me. I retain a space in which, because the retention of that space is a prerequisite to freedom. I'm unfree if I'm given over to their demand. So I hold sacred, as Tara Brach talks about, that pause, for example. There's no right answer, obviously, to this question. It's more like, what's your answer to what is sacred for you, including holding out for just remarkable, beautiful states of mind? Thank you. That's great. Thank you. It could be sacred to say, I'm going to do a life like this that has room in it for what really matters most. And I'm going to give up the rewards of stuffing it with other things, which are rewarding often, but I'm going to give up those lesser rewards for a greater one, which is what the Buddha often said is the essence of wisdom, giving up a lesser good for a greater one. Maybe one more person and I'll keep going. Great.
For me, it's sort of connecting dots. And I noticed that when I'd be driving home from work, crossing the Richmond Bridge, and I'd really notice that the sky was beautiful. Mm. And then I connect it with a dot of something else, like a kindness or And connect and letting grace come in when it's there.
Yeah.
And also, you know, seeking it.
Yeah, that's great.
Know, seeking solace in nature or friendship, family.
That's great.
I sort of see them as dots that connect.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of bring you up out of the gray zone.
Yes. Oh, good. Thank you. This week, tonight, you might, driving home, you might ask yourself, what is truly sacred to me? Or, and what do I think is still possible for me in terms of beautiful states of mind, beautiful periods or experiences, and without falling in pitfalls of clinging or attachment to them, you know, what's true for me about preserving more room for these in my life, or even encouraging them, or being a stand for them, and not letting the everyday gray world, you know, drag me into beige. One more person, then I'll move on.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's doing things that that I'm in the moment, that I'm mindful with, which it seems like 99% of what I do is not that.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
There's a lot of minutia and running around, and I'm a singer. Classical singer, and you know, there'll be times when I'll, you know that I have to prepare something, and I'm exhausted, and I think, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And you know, by the end, you know, I'm energized, I'm happy, you know, I'm happy, and I feel alive.
Great.
You know, and there's, you know, connections with people, you know, another thing, but there's some of the other comments that, you know, I need, for me at least right now, it feels like I need something really concrete to hold on to. And that's the thing that, you know, that feels concrete.
Yes. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, and I appreciate what you're saying too about it can get kind of woo-woo, you know, but it really is helpful to have a sense of what is, you know, concrete.
Well, because it's, when you really think about it, to be truly mindful and present, what you're doing, you know, there's very few things, at least for me, that I feel that I have that.
Yeah, that's right.
But when you do it,
it can become sacred.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. That's great. So, moving on. So with that, just leaving that as kind of a foundation, I want to talk almost technically about how to do bliss in meditation. All right? It's a little bit of an inside baseball conversation, a little detailed, but hopefully it'll be of some use to you. So, and see if this is relevant to you. If you're interested in concentration practices, meditative practices, rapture, at least according to the Buddha, is a very important factor to explore and try to cultivate and take seriously. And do what you can to learn how to do it. I think of it as building out slots in the neural motherboard, you know, for the capacity to go into rapture increasingly easily. You kindle these states in the brain. You make the brain more accessible to going here. So in terms of cultivating rapture, typically energy is needed. There needs to be a kind of energy that's often the result of almost building up or charging the battery by preceding the tipping into rapture or the calling it forth by spending 10, 20 minutes straight really focused on concentration, really attempting to become absorbed in some object of attention like the breath. So of the two types of meditation practices I talked about tonight in my suggestions, focused attention compared to open awareness, rapture tends to come more readily, in my observation, from initially doing focused attention, where you're really on something like the sensations of breathing, and you abandon everything else, and you bring a muscularity to it. That's kind of how we charge the battery. We sort of build up things so it can happen. Another thing to do, and it's a traditional instruction or suggestion, is to call it forth. May piti arise. May rapture arise. There's an invitation. There's an invocation. There's an evocation of it. We don't We don't grab it by the throat. We invite it. We woo nature, you know, to come forth into the clearing in the mind and really take its place there. So that's a thing you can do. May rapture arise, and then see what happens. I've found that it helps to sometimes quicken the breath, to inhale more vigorously, or to even get a sense of an arising energy. May rapture arise. That, you know, there's a fine line between helping it and demanding it. Try to stay on the side of helping it. I have no idea if this overlaps with Kundalini, but you know, I feel sometimes a kind of pumping at the base of my spine to kind of help it ignite, and then I let it emerge and develop. For me, it is a little bit like striking flint or trying to light a fire, and preparing the kindling and the tinder for the fire through the previous 10, 20 minutes of practice, and then trying to encourage the blaze to get going. Sometimes all you get is that spark. You get that initial surge of a sort of pleasure in the body, rising energy, a kind of a bliss feeling, a delight feeling, and then it subsides. Or after a while, sometimes it really does catch fire. Okay. Now, for some people, even though the traditional order is to start with rapture and then move to happiness or joy, sukha is the Pali word for that. It's the root of the word for sugar, sucrose, since Pali and Sanskrit basically intertwine as languages. There's a sweetness there. I think sometimes it helps to start with what's more available, which is the basic quality of happiness or contentment or tranquility. And then, as one can, bring a concentration to that and an energy to that, and then go to rapture. So invert the traditional order. I find that that helps sometimes. And if rapture doesn't come, it really is okay to stay in this actually more refined and peaceful state of mind that is sukha. PT can feel a little jangly. I've had times where it's like enough bliss already, you know? To use an extreme example, there are people who have basically, in part due to epileptic seizures, they will have multiple orgasms a day. And the thrill wears off really quickly. If you're coming multiple times a day in the elevator, at work, it's a little strange, you know? And so along that spectrum, PT itself can start to feel like too much. And then it's nice to settle down into the subtler sukha of happiness, contentment, or tranquility. So it's okay to go there anyway. It's also possible to make rapture or bliss the object of concentration. This is an important little detail if you're practicing with concentration. You start, let's say, with the breath. Then you get these other states of mind really going. To really become absorbed in them, you could shift attention to bliss itself as the object of awareness. That's a suggestion that was given to me by Christina Feldman, one of my core teachers, and it was very useful when working with concentration practices. One can do this as well with the sukha spectrum of joy that runs from happiness to contentment to tranquility. Each one of those can become an object of attention. Shifting the object of attention too much tends to disrupt concentration and absorption, and it tends to withdraw fuel, logs, if you will, from the fire. But a few shifts over the course of a 45-minute set, if it works for you, just fine. If you don't get it, if it's not happening, just drop it. Don't worry about the bliss. Go back to the breath itself or other object, or marinate even more in this quality of happiness, contentment, and tranquility. Okay, that's a bit of technical instruction about how to do meditation. Myself, when I got this from my teacher, I was so glad, because like, okay, I get it. It's like instructions. These are steps to do. All right, any questions about this bit? And then I'll move to a wrap with some Thich Nhat Hanh. Anyway, great, Lily? Right. Okay. And that gets at a general question, too. So let's suppose that because it's considered to be a wholesome factor, of a kind of quality of happiness. How do we relate to that? Well, one, we relate to it as a means to an end. We try to steer clear of getting attached to it, or, you know, attached to it and fixed on it and driven around it. We enjoy it, we like it, but we don't tip into craving, clinging, and suffering around it. Second, we appreciate that by cultivating this state of mind, especially with the findings of modern science, neurons that fire together, wire together, as we activate this beautiful state of mind, it's sinking into the brain. So that in the body altogether, really, in all its intertwining systems. So increasingly, it becomes woven into us, and it's present not based on external conditions. There are two kinds of happiness. There's the happiness that's the result of external conditions. It's fine. I'm all for it. Kid finally, you know, wins the race, or you get a bigger check in the mail, or your preferred candidate wins the election, or your team wins the Super Bowl, or suddenly you discover amazing goat cheese at the Marin County Farmers Market. In my case, like, wow, that stuff's good. Okay, but that happiness is based on conditions which are unreliable bases. They're not bad, but they're not ultimately reliable bases of a deep, enduring happiness, which is the Buddha's aim, and I think our aim as well. That second kind of happiness is not based on conditions. It's a happiness we take with us increasingly wherever we go. And it's a happiness or a basic well-being that can become the container for sorrow, pain, fear, loss, and so forth, but those contents of mind ultimately don't touch that fundamental basis of happiness, that space of well-being underneath it all. So that's the context. How do we do it? One way is to find that which is pleasant in this moment as it is. Or simply, as you become more in the now, it just becomes increasingly amazing, everything that's arising in this moment, including just in awareness. Like, wow, there's so much fizziness in the mind altogether. How could anyone want more? There's just so much, right? So we find that. And it's also okay to deliberately think of things that call it up, if you're trying to activate it. Whatever makes you feel grateful or glad. And after a while, honestly, talk about building out slots in the motherboard, you truly become more able at will to activate these states of mind. I mean, for me in my own practice, so especially over the last, I'd say, about 15 years, three things have really, really, really made a difference for me. And each one of them, I didn't realize at the time what a big difference it was going to make. And the first was focusing on concentration practices, focusing on the fundamentals of steadiness of mind, including tipping into and opening to and being serious about or committed to non-ordinary states of awareness, valuing them much as the Buddha has. The second thing that really had a big effect on me, not just in terms of Buddhist practice, but in my life altogether, has been positive emotion, appreciating that happiness is skillful means and treating it in a sacred way, making it matter, setting it aside, setting it apart as something I valued, positive emotion, including intense positive emotion. Now, if I want to, just factually, I could just activate happiness at will, because it's in there. It's in the motherboard. Obviously, there'd be moments where I couldn't, I'm sure, just do it. It'd be totally inappropriate. A terrible thing has happened, let's say, or something like that. But in general, we get to a point where we can just call these up. The Buddha, at will, could just go into the third jhana, just casually, because he was so trained in that way. The third thing that has really helped me has been generosity. Totally stunned, the power of generosity, including little forms of generosity, little moment, giving someone 10 more seconds than habit would do, or 10 more minutes, or 10 more dollars. And generosity has been amazing, my personal experience. So I nominate these two. So we can think of things that make us happy while meditating. We can stay with it. We can try to, you know, create sanctuary for it in our mind, and we can deepen in it. We can explore nuances of it, exploring the nuances of the differences between or among happiness, contentment, and tranquility as discrete states of mind, and marking these distinctions so that we know what they are and how to move around among them. This is yogic training. We are in a yogic, to the extent that a person is genuinely doing Buddhist practice, it's not just a wisdom practice. It's a moral practice and a yogic practice. Those are the three great pillars of practice. You know, wisdom, virtue, and mindfulness or concentration. So I'm talking about here about factors of, in particular, the concentration wing of practice. Maybe another person, then I'll move toward a wrap. Yeah. Yeah, I'm using that term a little loosely as the idea that it would be a little bit as if we're here about tennis, okay? We're here about tennis. Now, how could we be here about tennis? You know, tennis. Well, one, we could talk about being fair, the virtue side, if you will, of tennis. Being moral tennis players, the rules of tennis, the traditions, you know, different debates about proper rules. We could do that. We could even talk about tennis strategy, like what works, or even, what works, or the history of the game, the larger implications, the wisdom related to tennis. And third, in particular, we could train in doing it better and better and better. That's what I mean by the yogic angle here. And I'm using the word deliberately to kind of strike a chord that even in 21st century, very upper middle class, often not always Marin, full of technology, to some extent we are standing in an ancient tradition that runs all the way back to history and prehistory. And I personally am sure the kind of trainings and techniques and methods for the human nervous system that were developed by the Buddha's great teachers were also developed thousands of years before that and thousands and thousands and thousands of years before that. Every indigenous culture that's ever been encountered in the world has a contemplative tradition in it, which involves typically trainings of this kind in non-ordinary states of awareness. It's kind of powerful to consider that part of what we're doing is we're engaging a deep yogic training of body and mind, as well as cultivating virtue and cultivating wisdom. All right. Okay. We'll wait on you, Thich Nhat Hanh. Sorry. Great Vietnamese sage. Yes. Beautifully said. Thank you. Right. Happiness often comes from just heartfeltness. I think that's a real way in, especially for a lot of people. Who do you love? What do you love? You just started smiling instantly, you know, right? It just touches us. Or can we be more heartfelt itself? Heart is a positive emotion that can become another object of attention. If we have whatever we have access to, that's really a great thing to focus on. All right, Tom? Yep, Tina and Steve.
My impression from listening to them was that extended time was really a critical condition of a concentration practice.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that from you tonight.
Right. Well, great point. So I'm not talking about concentration practices in a comprehensive way. I'm really mainly talking about one particular aspect, and I'm talking about what I consider to be in reach for a regular personal sitting practice. You know, if you're meditating routinely, and ideally for more than a few minutes, at least more than a few times a week, right? No personal questions will be asked. I think this is within reach, especially if you already have some capacity in this direction. That said, traditionally, to really deepen concentration, it's presumed that people would set aside real time, whether it's over the course of a day, that's a lot right there, or many days in a row, like doing a retreat, or many months in a row. And the tradition that Steve and Tina came from would routinely do 3-month retreats. That's a lot of practice. And I'm all for that. I've personally gone the deepest I've ever gone in those kind of settings. But I think it's also okay to use what's useful in everyday life. So So for me, both are really true. Maybe I could finish with a little quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, and we could wrap up. All right? Okay, good. And I'll just finish with a, actually, I'll start with a little quote from Rick Hansen. Yeah, I'll just say to you, so I won't say who the name of this person is, but if you know the kind of spirit rock teaching cadre, this is probably the last person you would expect. I won't even name the gender. I won't help you at all. Who would have said this. And this person is kind of an exemplar of rectitude and doing things procedurally by the book. So I was telling this person about my own practice and the fact that I was drawn to kind of go further than I was told to go, or that I had read about certain states and I was interested in them, and I was getting intimations of them, and I wanted
to. You're talking about the multiple orgasms?
No. We give that up on retreat altogether, but anyway. And I was kind of nervous about it because this person had also been a little bit of an authority figure for me in that spirit rock world. And this person just twinkled and said, well, to be really honest, a similar thing had happened for this person. And then this person said, essentially, go for it. Now, if you're prone to psychosis or, you know, really crazy experiences of depersonalization and losing your way, don't go for it. Don't go for it. Get the glue organized in the matrix, the mosaic of the psyche. But if you have reasonably good glue, reasonably good footing, background, go for it. Unglue. Let the tiles start popping off the matrix and become more and more aware of the space in between them. You know, and start really appreciating more and more that the space between the tiles is our true home. Go for it. But to do that, there has to be a certain muscularity to it. And again, that's where positive emotion can come in, like the joy or the bliss, because it helps fuel that muscularity over time. Then, Thich Nhat Hanh, finally. He talks about that what helps us take care of painful feelings is starting by taking care of positive ones. He says, the Buddha advises us to create the feeling of joy and happiness in order to nourish ourselves before we deal with the painful feelings. Just as a surgeon may judge that a patient is too weak to undergo surgery and recommends that the patient first get some rest and nourishment so she can bear the surgery, so we need to strengthen our foundation of joy and happiness before focusing on our suffering. We can start with joy. Joy and happiness are always there as seeds in our consciousness. Breathing in, I'm aware of the feeling of joy in myself. Breathing out, I smile to the feeling of joy that is in myself. Breathing in, I'm aware of the feeling of happiness in myself. Breathing out, I smile to the feeling of happiness in myself. In joy, he's speaking of piti, rapture or bliss, and in happiness, he's talking more about sukha, which runs from happiness to contentment to tranquility. So how about we take a moment and just play a little bit with Thich Nhat Hanh's practice here. Breathing in, I'm aware of, you know, the feeling of joy or happiness. Breathing out, I smile to or I bow to the feelings of joy and happiness inside myself. So we'll do this for just a minute or so, and then you'll hear the hyoza gong. Just smiling to the sound. Thank you for your attention and practice. And next week I'll talk about tranquility, the next factor of awakening. So see you then. You're welcome to hang out and also help us straighten up.